Paul Hardick, who is most recently the man who wrote the novel Tinkers. Paul, how are you doing?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing all right.
All right, great. It's good to see you, man. Yes. Glad that we can talk.
I'm glad we can talk, too. We were talking before all this about the idea of novels, whether or not they can actually serve as a handbook for life, something I don't necessarily believe in. I don't think you do. But I wanted to address that because, well, your book, Tinkers, does in fact present life. And I'm wondering how you as a writer, when you were writing this, or just in general, how you arrange text, maybe just as a jumping off point here, mm-hmm. as a way to present life as opposed to dictate life. Was this ever a struggle for you when writing this? Or?
Not with this. I think I had sort of done my apprenticeship to bad prescriptive moralizing writing and just ended up writing basically very bad propaganda, you know, that was just designed to show people how progressive and enlightened and generous and, you know, intelligent I was. And then you know, I'd say the kind of operative word is just description and precision of description. And if you describe things precisely, you get at a kind of, you know, you end up kind of like bearing witness to the truth of your characters, in this case, characters' lives, in a way that sort of does them the kind of moral justice that's misplaced when you think you're going to moralize. And so it's kind of more... for me, it even starts with the writing process of, you know, the difference between writing declarative prose and writing interrogative prose.
Yeah.
Like, I don't presume that I know something and I'm going to tell you how it is, and then afterwards, if you're lucky, you'll be as smart as me. Or, you know, what I do is, you know, I try to write interrogatively, discover things, work through revelation. It's just a type of aesthetic, you know. But then what you leave on the page behind you is, you know, when the reader reads what you've written, the reader will make the same kind of have the same kind of revelations and moments of recognition. You know, I mean, to me, that's like the greatest experience as a reader, those moments of recognition where you know, you read something and you simultaneously realize, I've always known that's true. I've never thought about it consciously, and I've never seen anybody put it into language before. And to me, so there's a kind of morality to that. There's some sort of confirmation of common humanity or whatever, but it's not sort of prescriptive, you know, small-minded, minor kind of moralizing. So,
I'm very glad that you brought up description, because one thing that I really think is interesting about this book is the hyper-specific nature of the description. To offer an example, you have George reading by the dim light of a small pewter lamp set on the roll-top desk at the far end of the couch. Now, that's extremely specific, and I'm wondering if that serves as a way for you to get the reader inside George's head, or is this a way for you as a novelist to kind of know where everything is situated? I mean, it's the only person I think who writes that hyper specifically is possibly like William Gibson or something like that. But a lot of the 19th century authors
Well,
do
that's
do that.
And I've certainly spent all my reading time trolling around 19th and early 20th century fiction. So, I mean, I always think of the Thomas Mann's little preface he has to The Magic Mountain about, you know, we will be long on detail, but when was a book ever short on interest that was long on detail? You know, people would argue against him, you know, that novel's glacial, but it's sort of both of what, it's a bit of both, which is while I'm writing, I'm blocking the scene out, you know, and since my character's, Tinkers anyways, I'll just keep it, you know, is it's so interior that I knew from the beginning that I had to really keep the world embodied. I had to keep it like sort of physically, tangibly present, because otherwise it would just be feasting on ether. So there's that. There's the kind of geography of the room, but then it's also to make the reader feel like he or she has been put in a real place. You know, actually put in a place where there's a chair to your left. I mean, there's a certain physical feeling you get when you feel like there's a chair to your left and a sofa over here and a painting over there. That sort of thing. I also, I just believe in the virtue of concrete nouns and verbs, and just find also I think it's true too that there ends up being something hyper real rather than surreal about it. But there's a really cool kind of whole bandwidth of unintended effects that you can't predict. But if you use that process of total precision, almost pointless precision, that you end up getting into these kind of transcendent or metaphoric realms, but not by lifting up off out of the world or evaporating off of it, but by going deeper into what's imminent.
Yeah.
So you get so materialistic about it, but then it suddenly turns into something you don't recognize, and you sort of double back on yourself, and it becomes unrecognizable and sort of unsettling and hyper real. So I love that. I mean, I just love that phenomenon. You know.
Yeah. But it's not just also in relation to materialism. It's also in relation to place. I mean, of course, the clock theme that goes throughout with the reasonable horologist,
which
I presume was invented.
Oh, yeah, that's all invented. Yeah. Sure.
I'm wondering if that text within the text was included almost as a way to, I suppose, distract the reader from the fact that the text, the prose itself, is almost written in this kind of William James 19th century mode, and that by having this, you can almost justify the style that you're doing within the actual prose itself.
Yeah. It's a little bit of, from the on the most generic level, it's just to change things up. It's just to use relief. It's to be able to set. You know, so much of the book is very somber and funereal and twilight, and this is just a little bit more verbose and florid and kind of tongue in cheek. It's kind of humorous. I mean, I think of it as kind of, and so it keeps the textures changing. But yeah, I think it's also true. I mean, I think that the writing is, because the writing is formal, and that kind of precision leads to that kind of, it sounds formal, so it sounds archaic to some extent. It was also just a fun way to just, write in that kind of like, welcome, dear reader, to reason.
Yes.
You know, which just sort of worked emotionally with the character, the George, the clock repairman, his upbringing was so chaotic and disorderly that, that idea of the deterministic and, mechanical view of the universe is appealing to him. The idea that you can fix things, that it's mendable, and that there's an order to everything is sort of, resonates with him. So it was just cool to just juxtapose all. And then there's also, one of the sort of dramatic givens, one of the premises of the book that was non-negotiable, was that he was a clock repairman, just because he's loose. My own grandfather was a clock repairman. But kind of halfway in, I was writing about it, and kind of halfway into writing the book, I realized this could sound like a very tired metaphor, but it's weird because I didn't just pick it because, I'll write about time. It's just that was what the material presented itself as. So then there was also just a kind of a personal thing to sort of like, how can I give a new look at what could otherwise, if I'm not conscious of it the whole time, be kind of like, clocks and the clockwork universe, just kind of off the rack. So it's just constantly looking for new visions of, or looks at, or variation, meaningful variations on that kind of, those kind of metaphors.
Characters almost serve as a variation, like Gilbert, the guy with the toothache. He claims to have gone to school with Nathaniel Hawthorne.
Right,
but,
exactly.
Of course, the math doesn't add up.
Right, that's right.
In light of the fact that the last of Reverend Davenport's passages is all about the clock resembling the universe and those who merely tread over the surface, but the funny thing about Reverend Davenport is that he's also treading over the surface, so that basically great expansive face that means utterly nothing, that serves almost as a philosophical MacGuffin. I wanted to ask how characters like Gilbert came from what seems to me a creative tension on your part towards, I've got this theme of a clock. How do I actually put it within the context of this narrative? It kind of is a philosophy, but it isn't a philosophy. It's actually, the philosophy matters in relation to the character. Tell me about this.
Well, so the way I think of that is, that's one of the things that I love about writing fiction, rather than being a philosopher, is that I don't have to prove anything.
Yeah.
Right? So you can, your novel, within a dramatic narrative, you can take up any philosophy you like and just, use it to power the sort of dramatic and aesthetic kind of underpinnings of any given set piece or passage in the novel. And then you're under no obligation to convince the reader that it's true. You're under the obligation to just convince the reader that it was worth your time, your mutual time, to have just looked at and considered as thoughtful, aesthetic, beings. And then what you can do, what's really nice, is, again, according to this, the generic principle of juxtaposition, you can pick up the diametrically opposed philosophy to the one that you were just modeling, and model that as fully and as unjudgmentally and without partisanship, and just put them next to each other. So now we're obviously into like triadic dialectics or synthetic, but you put them next to each other, and dramatically Well, I mean, that would be a contradiction if it was logic or if it was an argument or, you know, a reason, you know, if you were doing reasoning. But dramatically, aesthetically, poetically, you can just put them next to each other and they generate all sorts of overtones and harmonies that's what you're going for as a writer of fiction.
Yeah.
You know, it's because what you want to do is just keep opening the world up. You don't want to solve any unsolvable mysteries or whatever. You just want to sort of just open it up for your reader and just get the universe ringing, you know, and sort of leave it to the reader's imagination.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, this is interesting because one of the things I very much enjoy about the novel is that you present life choices for these characters, and there is no ideal position to be in. I mean,
right.
No matter where you end up, you're going to have pros, you're going to have cons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I appreciate that, but it seems to me that this likewise applied to any kind of philosophy you drew from. Is it safe to say that? That philosophy proved to be as fungible as characterization here?
I think, yeah, definitely. And I think, and part of it, I mean, this then starts to cross over into the fact, you know, I'm unabashedly a fan of transcendentalism, you know, Emerson, Thoreau, and what I like, and I mean, I think part of why these writers and that milieu or that genre or how, you know, the philosophy, the aesthetics is so appealing to writers of fiction and to poets is because it's experiential.
Yeah.
So it's not objectively trying to prove the nature of being. It's subjective, and so it's trying to describe the experience of being a human without trying to say, oh, well, you know, all consciousness is actually just neurons firing, or there is no soul, or, you know, whatever. It's just sort of like independent of those, you know, of those arguments, which are interesting to, you know, to chew on, but the fact is, you know, we experience ourselves as selves, as having an I, you know, first person, and, you know, and the way that you, you know, what you know is not always how you feel, but how you feel is kind of what, or sometimes often enough in Tinkers and in subsequent writing, it's the difference between what you know and how you feel, the discrepancy between that, which is often so irreconcilable. That's what I'm interested in doing, you know. And again, it's that idea that what you want to give your readers are moments that where they recognize the complexity of their own experience, their own ambivalence, their own contradictory ideas, all that sort of thing. So,
but on that subject, there's also that early moment when George is attempting to dictate his life,
right?
And it's one of the saddest things where he plays back what he's just heard, and he is astonished to hear this bumpkin, this uneducated man,
and
it's far less from any of the, well, on the page too, it sounds really interesting, all of his story. And so it's almost as if you're suggesting that there's a certain futility in trying to come to terms with life in a certain sense.
Yeah, or it's, I don't know, you know, because this is where it's sort of, you know, I'm not interested in, you know, I just think that the mystery of our existence is ours to ponder but not solve. You know, I just don't believe that you can sort of get to the bottom. I don't think a subject can get to the bottom of itself objectively.
Yeah.
By definition of being subjective. You know, but, you know, like, you can't project yourself out of, you know, very Kantian, like, you know, space and time or functions of our own physiology or whatever. But, I'm sort of not interested. But that doesn't mean you stop. You know, I like to me, so it's interesting, and it's sort of, I've been reading a bunch of Beckett lately and just thinking, you know, how existential he is.
Yeah.
But he's the darkest existentialist, you know, but he's not hopeless.
Yeah.
And that, I think too often it's the idea that, like, existentialism is a form of hopelessness, as opposed to, no, because he's constantly bearing witness to the struggle to be a human being, you know, which is a tough road to hoe. And like, that's, like, to me, that's affirmative.
Yeah.
You know, and just the whole idea that, like, I'm just going to keep saying yes until there's no self left to say yes, you know.
I totally agree.
Which is really beautiful. You know, I just think that's a really incredibly soulful, affirmative, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's anything bleak about, I mean, the bleakness is the truth of how, you know, a lot of life is bleak.
You're talking about being both an optimist and a realist, essentially.
Well, I think that's what, that's a sliding scale, right? You know, one person's optimism is another's,
but,
you know.
But one can be a skeptic, but one can also be giddy about it. Just as one can be ontological and intense, but one does not necessarily have to be humorless, you know?
Right, yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah, and I just think that that's, it opens you up to more, you know, I think of it aesthetically, you know, and to me, there's no separation between aesthetics and morals. It's like what you find is beautiful is what you find valuable. What you find is valuable are your values, i.e. your morals. You know what I mean? Like, I think the second anybody starts to separate aesthetics and morals for anything but the most, like, you know, strict definitional, you know, they're about to get up to no good.
But what about aesthetics and philosophy? For example, in this book, as a novelist, the difference between the conceptual trap or the conceptual consolation prize or even the conceptual panacea versus what you were describing syntactically, both in terms of the phrasing, both in terms of the text within the text, both in terms of the wonderful little How to Make a Bird's Nest essay, which I like so much, which reveals in its instructions this giddy sense that Howard has.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess it's one of those things where you just hope that they just all become inextricable. It just all be, you know, everything just ends up mutually reinforcing itself. And I mean, it goes back. I mean, because I'm thinking a bit more like back to like, okay, so when I remember writing the passage about the bird's nest, and that was I did it interrogatively, the way I was just, you know, just describing, which is I just thought, okay, if you were actually gonna, what would the rules be? And then I just started writing it and just thinking, okay, so then you'd need to, you know, lash these little tin things like a beak to your ends of your fingers, and you'd only use one strand at a time, because it's, you know, astonishing how birds make nests. And then I just kept extending the metaphor and kept extending it and extending it. And it's giddy, because while I was writing it, I was thinking, Jesus, that would actually be kind of cool if you know. And then just what's left in the passage is my own giddiness as an author. But then it worked, because all of the writing that I was doing is bracketed in the context of, like, I was writing in character, but I was also writing as an author. But the reader will, you know, so it's just this kind of cascading or telescoping kind of series of kind of concentric levels of the writing, where it works no matter what level you look at it on, hopefully. And I think going back to that idea of, you know, the existentialism and you know, the sort of affirmation or whatever, it's I mean, I always think of, you know, to me, the uber example is Moby Dick, you know, which is basically Melville takes the whaling ship, cuts it down the middle, opens it up like a cross section, and more or less, I mean, it's not quite this programmatic, but it's, you know, he goes from job to job, and he takes each job and he turns it into an extended metaphor for the cosmos. He makes these instant transcendentalist cosmologies out of, oh, look at the Cooper in his barrel and the hoops and the staves, and mustn't that be like, you know, creating a universe? And what he does is he writes it so beautifully and so precisely that you wholly give yourself over to, you know, by the end of the passage, you're thinking, my God, the universe is like a barrel. Yeah. And then he deflates the metaphor.
Yes.
He says, oh, no, this is silly, because you're going to fall out of the crow's nest if you keep daydreaming like this. And then he says, oh, but look at over there, they're boiling the blubber.
Yes.
And then he just does it, and it's just this beautiful idea that you can never solve the mystery of being, being in time.
Yeah. And Mel was also really excited about this. Like, I think of the chowder chapter, which I love.
Oh,
I mean,
exactly,
that's one of the best descriptions I've ever
read. And the
whale
ballet, oh my God, it's just, and what it is, and so, but what makes you giddy is that what he's modeling too is that getting to the bottom of it is not only impossible, or, you know, it's kind of a chicken or the egg thing, but like, so, I mean, the premise is that you can't get to the bottom of it. That's not the conclusion. That's a very moral and aesthetic difference between saying, I can't get to the bottom of it, so fuck it, or whatever. You know, like, it's like, no, you can't get to the bottom of it, so let's not even try. So when you explore and extend the metaphors, you know you're not going to get to the bottom of it, but what can you get to? You know, and even just the idea of that there's a hopefulness to, I know this metaphor is going to fail at some point, but that is not going to stop me from making another one afterwards.
Yeah. Metaphor should not get in the way of depicting what it is for these characters to be alive.
Exactly, right. And metaphor should be actually, and that's, again, that telescoping.
It serves as an enhancement,
exactly. And that's, you know, like, so in Tinkers, all the, you know, naturalistic, and it's heavy on description of landscape and nature and all that. But I'm never just describing a landscape. It's always being filtered through a character's perception. You know, the writer I think of, you know, sort of my go-to guy when I think of that is Wallace Stevens. You know, and the weather and the light and, you know, the auroras of autumn and all this sort of stuff being just refractions of mind.
Yeah.
you know, in the objective world is just, they're just refractions of consciousness, you know?
Does this account for some of the goofy similes in this, like the bank manager, like a fleshy Olympian pair dressed up in a three-piece suit?
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah. I hadn't thought about that one in a long time, but that sounds to me like early Wallace Stevens.
Yeah.
Sounds like something out of Harmonium, just like you go, I'm a fan of precision and all this, but I am on the austerity program, you know, but it's not supposed to be dour. I mean, I like the plumage of language, you know. I like, you know, like when language erupts into its own, you know, just like sort of erupts for its own sake into its own complexity sometimes. I mean, you have to be very careful because then you become drunk on the language or, you know, like, because I write the way I write, one of my terrors is of writing prose that is merely pretty.
Yeah.
You know, as opposed to like, or it sounds poetic, but it's actually not poetry because it's actually not about anything. It's just, you know, moon, spoon, June prettiness, you know, which drives me crazy. I hate, you know, that it's ornamentalism.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want it to be this rococo, you know.
This makes me ask you how you agonize over a sentence to avoid this dreadful ornamental quality you're identifying.
Right. Well, that goes back to then precision.
Yeah.
Which is usually ornamentalism, usually overly florid prose is a form, ends up being, like if you go into the prose that you think is too ornamental and you start, you know, like knocking finials off and, you know,
yeah.
Usually what you'll find is that it's almost all of it is in some form or another exaggeration.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just that sort of, if you want to get, you know, no meaning but in the thing itself, you know, there's that still that kind of discipline of, if this is going to be beautiful, it's not going to be beautiful because I gilded the lily. It's going to be beautiful because I described it as precisely as possible. And that will be, there will still be a richness to the language. Like, don't worry about it. It's still going to be beautiful. It's still going to be gorgeous. But the beauty is going to be more located in what's in the thing itself that you fetch back and precipitate or condense out of the thing into language, as opposed to the language that you drape over the thing. You know, but I mean, when you drape language over the thing, it's a temptation because it makes you look like you're a good writer.
Yeah.
And you know, we've all read books where it's just sort of like you get to the end of the book and you don't think, what a beautiful book I've just read. You think, wow, isn't that guy smart or isn't he a good writer? Which I don't want people thinking about me.
But in an Olympian pair in a three-piece suit, you're dealing with some level of exaggeration.
The question is how much
exaggeration is enough?
Well, I mean, hopefully in that, I mean, very little. You know, you want to make it, you want to hit your mark and get out. You know what I mean? Because it's just a little goes a long way.
So,
unless you really just erupt into satire when exaggeration kind of becomes the point and then you're doing something else very consciously with exaggeration.
So it seems to me that from your standpoint, there is something to be said for the ratio of precision in relation to hyperbole.
I think that's right.
That if the more precise the sentence is, the more you can get away with, provided that there's some meter here.
Yeah, there's ballast.
Yeah,
that's right. And I think, as you mentioned this too, you know, that hyperbole is not applied to one of the main characters. You know what I mean? Like, you know, this other guy just has kind of a walk-on part, and he's kind of a fall guy or a straight man or whatever. You know, that kind of thing. So you can kind of make him slightly exaggerated because he's on stage for a page
he's
and
a
half.
Player, yeah.
Right, exactly. And I think that's what you get to with even like Gilbert is a little bit.
Yeah.
He's a stock character. He's from the standard repertoire.
Yeah.
Kind of. And so he can be a little bit broad so long as his broadness is actually being used to draw more complexity out of the main character.
And this probably is a great way for you as a writer to burn off these inevitable energies that are going to come to you.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That's where side characters and side description serves as.
And it's great fun. Yeah. You know, I mean, I like that. I mean, I think one of the things is I think that there's more humor in the book sometimes than, you know, part of it is that kind of deadpan Down East kind of humor. So if you don't get it, you don't get it. Or if you don't like it, you don't like it. But, yeah, I mean, because I like the idea. I mean, I still feel like it's kind of an exuberant book in some ways, you know, but it's quiet still. You know, there's a quiet exuberance or whatever to it. But, yeah, I like, you know,
Yeah. Well, we've talked about metaphor on a sentence level. I wanted to see if we could talk about it on a book level.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
You know, for example, homes in this. We open up with a home that's completely collapsing, and then later on in the book we have the situation where the doc's home is being slowly pulled along the
yeah,
road.
Sure,
I,
yeah,
and,
yeah.
And I'm wondering how that that chronic displacement, you can't find a home in this book.
Well, that's one of the things. I mean, that's the houses thing is a great example of I'm writing interrogatively. I'm not paying it. I'm not trying to overdetermine it or whatever. I write, you know, I work on the thing for a year or 8 months or whatever. And then one day I sort of look back, read through the manuscript, and I realize, wait a minute, this book is full of unhousement.
Yeah.
And so then you can go back and you can say, okay, so now I can deliberately work on it, but I can deliberately work on it knowing that it was an emergent property of the stuff itself, because I didn't think it up ahead of time and then try to interject it into the book. It arose arose as a function of the work of art generating its own necessities.
Yeah.
Does that make sense? You know
yeah,
what I
no,
mean?
Totally,
and so
totally.
And so it and so but then when you look at it you think, oh, that's really cool because it starts with the house collapsing and then the doctor's house is being dragged across the town. Howard thinks of his wagon as a house as he's driving
that's
away
right.
from his own house. The bird's nest is a house. Kathleen, like the when they're sitting on the porch and the porch, so their house is like a nest and the other nest that you see is like a house. And so it's just that everything starts to mutually reinforce. But that said, and this is where that kind of like to me where the artfulness and the non-prescriptive type of writing is that it's just my job to just have those images and preserve them in their integrity and to preserve their mutual integrity, their mutually reinforcing integrity, but not to tell you what to think any of it means.
Yeah.
I mean, you know what I mean? Like,
well, this is interesting because symbolic symmetry for many writers comes about by accident. It seems to me that it both comes about by accident and is very deliberate.
Deliberative, yeah. And I think what I try to do, and that's the difference between shutting down further speculation, the aesthetics of, you know, I'm going to shut this down. This is going to be conclusive, you know, and I am not interested in that. Like, other than, like, plot or, like, I conclude, but just, like, when it's time to conclude, you just kill them. You know, like, everybody, you know, they die kind of thing. But I'm, like, when I find that thing with the houses, for example, my job is to open it up. And to open it up so that if any reader who likes to can just spend an afternoon thinking about, oh, all those different houses, and isn't that kind of cool? But at the end, it's not like, so now we know something. You've had the, you know, and so now Paul Harding has taught me something about unhousement. It's like, I wouldn't presume to tell you what unhousement, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's great for the reader, but for you as the author, if you're constantly leaving things open-ending, what do you do to, I guess, siphon the creative impulse off? Because you can keep on going all day on this just from a creative standpoint.
Right.
And here you have this just contained in, you know, a book that's less than 200 pages. If you if you were to tackle, like, a 500-page project, I think you would be completely lost, I would almost
think. Could be. I mean, and part of that is just you got to take what the defense gives you. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it just may be that I write relatively short, dense, lyrical, not non-plot driven, non-linear, impressionistic. You know what I mean? Like, this is just that's what you're gonna get from me, and you know, that's what I'm gonna get from, you know, the muse or whatever it is. Also, I mean, because it's not linear, I sort of write by thinking in terms of like volume or quantity. Like, I'll just keep writing. I will just like siphon off the creativity, and then there'll be some other marker on some other bandwidth of the writing or some other layer of the writing where then I know that's the perfect, like, okay, it's time to end that movement, or that's, like, not one note more. And that's when I'll resort to, like, okay, so there's all this creative kind of whatever, you know, that kind of the more aesthetic metaphorical stuff is going on. But then there's, like, an actual scene going, so then maybe it's just sort of like, okay, so then he turns and drives out of the driveway, and that's the end of this, and that's where we'll stop because there's a different part of the writing that's giving you the cue that, okay, you've done it. You've got enough. It's there.
Yeah.
You know, tie this one up for the day, put it next to the next one kind of thing.
Well, one basic question I never even got to ask you because we got so involved with this was, who came first between George and Howard?
Howard. So the premises of the book you could fit on half of a 3x5 index card, and they are factual. So it's based on family stories that my maternal grandfather told me about his own life growing up in Maine. His father had epilepsy, and his mother was going to have his father committed to an asylum. His father found out about it and left the family when my grandfather was 12. And also, my grandfather repaired and traded antique clocks, and I apprenticed with him, so that's how I know about the clocks. But I could never get my grandfather to tell me more about his upbringing. And I don't, you know, it's sort of a combination of, it was, you know, it just caused him grief to talk about it. But also, he had this kind of generational tact that I found, you know, like he and my, they're like, you don't talk about the depressing things. We're just going to look at the bright side. Yeah. We're going to, you know, we don't, so it's like, that's done. And you always think, oh my God, what terrible thing happened in the woodshed. But, you know, terrible stuff happened to them.
Yeah.
You know. So, but then when he died, you know, I mean, those were my bagats, you know what I mean? So, like, I, you know, it made, you know, the fact that it was my, they were my ancestors and he wouldn't tell me more about them made them irresistible. So I started just, I just took those very basic facts and then just started to work up imaginative, you know, subsequent imagined sentences, you know, literally just sort of like, what's the next sentence after he left his family, that sort of. So the very first thing I wrote in the book is, and I think it actually ended up almost being dead center in the book, is the scene where Howard first realizes that he's actually left his family. So he's passed his house in the mule cart, and it's just that in the first thing that caught my attention and interest was, what must it be like in the instant that you realize I've actually done what for me is the unthinkable.
Yeah.
And again, there's that discrepancy between what you know, what you think you should do, and what you actually have done.
Yeah.
And to him, that's unacceptable, but it's also unacceptable not to do it. Which is a, you know, that's, that kind of paradox is what you're always looking for as a writer.
Yeah.
That kind of like, it's absolutely impossible that this should happen, so you make it happen and you put the character in that.
But we, one thing we haven't really discussed is that this generational transmutation of what parts means. And by that,
of what means?
Of what parts mean.
Mm-hmm.
The very beginning of the book, we have board game parts, mass-produced elements pouring down on George.
Right.
At the end of the book, and I'm going to try my best not to give it away, Howard has found a certain role where, I mean, that's now frowned upon by contemporary society, where he takes great professional pride in placing all, I mean, well, hell, I'll just say it. He's a supermarket
grocery,
he's a baggage guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And he loves being able to rethink all those elements and put them in the bag.
Yep.
And it's that kind of quality that we now totally take for granted that was extremely, I mean, that he's perfectly happy with individually, yet we also frown upon from a societal standpoint, from a class elitism bullshit standpoint. I'm curious how the tension of these parts, you know, going from one generational perspective to another, where that factored in while we were kind of cobbling together this story based off of your grandfather and all that.
It's interesting. That's one of those things that's almost a subsequent observation.
Yeah.
You know, like sort of like I was not thinking about any
Got
of that
it.
Stuff. That's just a legitimate kind of byproduct of process, which is I'm just trying to pay attention to the individual characters and their experiences of their lives, and not another form of exaggeration, not sort of overstepping the boundaries of their very modest lives. So this guy would never have aspirations to become a great opera singer in the big city. You know what
sure.
I mean? Like these guys, like their lives were so proscribed that whatever version of satisfaction or success is, it's going to be correspondingly modest.
Yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, Howard leaves, you know, such a difficult situation. And then the situation that he finds himself in, afterwards is, I mean, relatively speaking, it's blissful.
Yeah.
You know, he ends up with a wife, you know, whatever, not to, you know, I'm happy giving, you know.
Yeah, well,
giving
we've already given it away. Yeah,
right,
yeah,
right.
Exactly.
But, you know, he ends up with a wife who's kind of the opposite of his first wife and, you know, and he has all these. And to him, it's just sort of what gives him peace of mind is actually that things are proscribed and they're orderly and he can put the world in order and he, you know, his second wife is just, you know, it's all, she wears her heart on her sleeve, you know, and
yeah.
It's just that. So, and then, so then thinking about those kind of generational things, I mean, this is something that people, you know, like it's just been a subsequent phenomenon because a lot of when I talk to older people who have read it, you know, they talk about remembering their own grandparents and even just like the move from the house in the woods to town.
Yeah.
That kind of happens here, but I never even thought about it.
Yeah.
I never even consciously thought about it. And so it just sort of naturally works and people recognize it because, I mean, that's the sort of faith you have in process, which is just sort of like, look, you take care of the individual characters and keep yourself focused on them. The other stuff will sort of fall into place, yeah. You know.
But even like, for example, Howard having to sell this new soap. Mm-hmm. I mean, this reminds me very much of the new and improved bullshit you have to buy from the supermarket. And I was thinking, man, you know, this Paul Harding kid, he's got this great way of showing parallel values across time, but also, as I mentioned, with the parts turning from, you know, how we place parts into larger containers, that you know, perception has changed over the years. So
I guess
the question I'm really asking you is about parallel ideas of what it is to live along these lines of how we handle items and how we handle materialism versus how much did you consider this when you were considering the generational shift here?
Well, I think part of it is, I mean, you know, so one of the things as a writer, I want to be, you know, you're a writer of your times, right?
Yeah.
But it's tough to write about, I mean, in some ways I did, or what one thing that I was relieved to find is that when I went back in time and started writing about these characters is that one of the things that sort of, the veil that drew back was just this veil of the spate of material culture. Like, these guys are not dutiful consumers, you know, and that's partly because they do not live in materially, overstuffed lives. And so it was just nice because, like, I think that's the problem. You know, a lot of contemporary literature laments it, but then the danger is that, you know,
it becomes part of it. Right.
You end up purveying a product that becomes the very thing that you're supposedly lamenting. You know what I mean? And so I'm just very, very self-conscious about that. But the idea, too, that behind all of this spate of material, you know, wealth or whatever, wealth seems like a wrong word for it, but, you know, like, there's a human brain still, you know, there's a human soul or whatever word you want to use.
Somebody,
like,
created
a mind.
That product, there's some sort of exploitation or avarice or something.
And our consciousness is just so distracted by all this, you know, technological, you know, I'm starting to think that, like, technology is now the opiate of the masses, right? It's just taken the place of just sort of, like, you just get distracted by the bright screen and then you're putty in the man's hands, you know, like, don't get me started, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So in a way it was sort of like, as a good citizen, I actually would like to be able to write about that sort of stuff. But aesthetically, I find that is what is ugly about our culture, and I don't want that ugliness in my book.
Yeah.
I'll get back to you on that. You know, because that's ongoing, it's interesting to think about because you want to be relevant in terms of, like, I still want to. But one of the nice things about this is that I just got back to, you know, just sort of birch bark metaphysics, you know, and just sort of think. So what happens when the mind just quiets back down to? There's not much to distract you, and so you fall back upon yourself and your own mind and your own spirit or soul, or how, you know, spirit in terms of, like, the spirit of the thing, you know, that kind of intention, that sort of thing. That's certainly one of the things that's pushing at the door, because Howard is hapless in the face, you know, and one of the things is when he tries to sell that new soap, he's bummed out because the woman is right.
Yeah.
He wouldn't otherwise argue with her. He's just like, and the guy that's his agent, who's just like, you know, installment plan, you know, installment payments and all that kind of stuff. So there's a little bit of that pressing at the door, but not too much of it.
But why should a novel even be concerned about staying current if human life as we live it essentially hasn't changed all that much? Yes, technology has totally adjusted the way we have changed.
Right. And I think I couldn't have said it better myself. That's kind of exactly how I feel, which is, you know, and then, you know, I don't want to, you know, then I end up arguing with, like, imagined, you know, antagonists. But there is that sort of, you know, I mean, and I think this is the other thing, too, is what the toughest thing in the world is being a human being. And there's nothing more natural to humans than to make ill-fated attempts at transcending their own humanity, which, you know, okay, so back when it was religion rather than science or whatever, I don't want to get too much, but you know, like, that was sort of like you were going to be an angel or whatever, or a devil or whatever. And then Darwin came along, so then we're all apes. And now we're all, like, parallel processors or whatever, but, like,
yeah.
it's everything but don't make me be a human being. You know what I mean? Like, don't leave me back. Like, don't make me fall back on my own humanity. But in the, so it's that weird kind of like, so what we do is we do this kind of counterfactual, we project ourselves forward into the future when we won't be human beings anymore. We'll have evolved out of our own humanity, thank goodness, vertically, you know, vertical separation, you know.
Some evolutionary dream almost, but it's all entirely mythical.
Right. It's totally rhetoric. It's total rhetoric. And that's the problem I have with a lot of, you know, this sort of weird materialist thinking now is because we really still fundamentally are the same physiologically, you know, like the brain is still basically what it's been. So it doesn't matter to me if I set my, you know, if I set my books 100 years ago, really nothing has changed in terms of being a human in the world. I mean, circumstantially it has, you know. And when I take the broad view, it's sort of like, but I don't really care. I mean, I'm not interested in consumer culture. Like, I'm a writer because I'm not interested in, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like being a salesperson or whatever. So why would I then go back and write about the world that I'm fleeing by virtue of being an artist rather than a banker or something like that? You know, that sort of thing. So, it's that sort of... But again, that's another question that you have to keep open because you don't want to be doctrinaire in the other way where, like, all I can write about is totally non-materialist, spiritual, birch bark, you know, like wandering out and looking at sun in the creek water.
You can't deny it'll certain become material essence of the way we live.
Exactly. So it's but that said, you know, so that said, like, I'm not actively seeking it, but if it comes up, I won't resist it either. And that's just part, and that's kind of more just like thinking in terms of as being an artist, like playing your long game. Like, I want to write some more books.
Yeah.
So if this stuff comes in, I can't just reject it out of hand because I disapprove of capitalist culture. You know, like I do, but you know, But here we are.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And I sort of, you know, so yeah.
Is having a very distinct voice, as this book does, really the way to solve the conundrum, the anti-capitalist solution, I suppose, of a novel reflecting life in some form at any point in human history?
Well, I mean, I think it's that kind of thing where, you know, everybody has a voice, and it's not like in that kind of like I'm free to be you and me kind of thing. But like
I was thinking the same thing.
Everybody does have their own voice, but it can atrophy. And what makes it atrophy is when you don't do the hard work of resisting the language that's given to you by the man. You know, but like you know, and so it's just sort of. I mean, you just think about sort of like Twitter and the fact that like language is just being dehydrated, and like, and so then like.
Well,
you can have
140 characters. You can use a 10-cent word.
And you can express yourself in 100, like, you know what? No thanks.
Yeah.
I'll just write a, you know, that sort of thing. So it's sort of, it's just that, like, that's what, like, we, that material clutter and the material white noise is what distracts us from the cultivation of our own voices and our own sensibilities. Is you just get this kind of prefab, off-the-rack, you know, an array, an apparent abundance of what actually, in fact, are off-the-rack, prefabricated selves. You know, like, you can be the cool alternative guy. You can be the, you know, the, and then you just, like, dress up in the right costume and say, I'm that guy. You know, and then you think for all the world that you actually have your own voice.
Yeah.
But you haven't. You've just consented to... You know, but, like having somebody give you your life for you, you know, your voice.
But on the other hand, there is probably right now, in a garret, there is a Paul Harding type who writes probably very similar to you.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's just...
Similarity is ineluctable to some degree.
But again, there's that beautiful, like, that's a dialectic. It's sort of like you can argue your way all the way to... Everybody, you know, if there's a universality, and then you can argue way right back to, no, it's all the individual and nobody's ever said it or seen it quite like you. And that's great. I'm happy to just, you know, move
oscillate,
back. As long as you understand that it is an oscillation.
Yeah.
It's not like you pound the spikes in at one end and you just make sure you never, ever, ever swing the other way because that's, you know, that's being doctrinaire.
Yeah.
It's just like being open to that. I mean, and I like the fact that a sentence or a book or any given moment can contain elements of both of those things, and they're not exclusive of one each other. In fact, like universality kind of loses its meaning when it's separated from the ballast of individuality. You know, and so does individuality. The idea of, like, you know, you're an individual to the extent also that you're a human being. You cast your lot in with your fellows. And the idea that it's you experience, there's a continuum,
yeah,
or a calculus to it that's always that should be dynamic. Sometimes we try to stop it, nail it down, and keep it there. But whether you like it or not, it keeps moving.
So the ambiguous nature of the form of fiction really allows one, or at least in your case, to oscillate ideally.
Right. And to do it, but the discipline there too is just to make sure that it doesn't lapse into coyness.
Sure.
You know. So yeah. I mean, I love that sort of stuff, and I think that's I just that's another one of those things I just find so pleasing, you know. And as a writer too, you find, you know, you've done your day's writing, you've drifted all the way over into universality, so you just realize, oh, so tomorrow morning the first thing I have to say is, you know, here's to the individual human spirit, and just work that way. And then again, that's another instance then where you have those two passages, you put them next to each other, and they resonate in all sorts of interesting ways, you know.
Well, on that note of extraordinarily free-form anti-dichotomy.
Yeah.
Pro-oscillation. Paul, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
Oh, likewise, man. Great conversation. Thank you.
Great, thanks.